This is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. On the program today, we'll be inviting people to call in with questions about prescription medications that they may be taking. And our guest for the program is Dr. James Rybacki. He has been with us many times before on this program. He is on faculty at University of Maryland, where he is clinical assistant professor. He is also the editor of a book that has been coming out now annually for a number of years that's titled The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. And the new edition, the one that's out now, is for 2005. It's published by HarperCollins. And the subtitle of the book is Everything You Need to Know for Safe Drug Use. It provides profiles of more than 300 drugs. So if you're taking a particular medication, you can look it up here, and it will tell you what it's for, how it works, possible interactions with other medicines that you may be taking, possible side effects, a lot of information, and in some cases, perhaps more information that may be provided to you by your physician or by your pharmacist. Certainly, they should provide that information, but it is right here in this book. And I think it's a good reference book, not a bad thing to have on your bookshelf at home, just to make sure that you understand the medicines that you and your family might be taking. Also, something that I think is very useful is because nowadays people are using more over-the-counter natural supplements. It also has a section that talks about potential interactions there and suggestions that if you are taking a supplement or if you're taking a prescription medication, that there are some cases you do not want to take those two things together. So it has that kind of information in there as well. In addition to the kind of work that the doctor has been doing now to try to educate people about prescription medicine, he is also working with guidelines for heart attack and stroke and abnormal cholesterol and peripheral artery disease. He's also involved in a project called Mended Hearts, and there was another book that at some point we'll mention that's specifically for people who have had heart disease. He is lead clinical consultant of the Medicine Information Institute, and he also has a website if you have access to the internet and you're interested in also more information about him and about prescription medicine. That is www.medicineinfo, all as one word, medicineinfo.com. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Dr. Rybacki, hello.
Hello. It's a rainy day here in Maryland, and I'm freezing. How are you?
It's about the same. Actually, it's dried out a little bit, but we had a lot of rain here overnight, and it's going to get colder. So it hasn't. It's the kind of day that I think I can deal with almost anything except rain and 40. That's pretty unpleasant.
Oh, the challenge for me in Nebraska always became rain, 40, and then ice, trying to leave the medical center.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly glad you can be with us once again.
Oh, you bet.
We appreciate it. I tell you what, I already have a caller here who's ready to go.
Oh, my gosh.
And
okay.
Rather than me launching into some questions, we will go ahead and talk with them.
Someone
on our local line here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is a cholesterol question.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about red yeast rice.
Ah.
I think you had actually mentioned it on your previous program, but I read the directions and it said, consult with your doctor if you have kidney or liver problems. I have only one good kidney. It's a good kidney, but it's just one. And I wondered if that's something I should take.
Well, the kidneys, of course, are your friends. You can't get by without a liver, and those are real challenging questions.
No,
and of course,
this is my kidney.
Okay, but still, at the reason for the warning on the label,
yes,
is that actually if you look in some of the parts of the essential guide, and if you actually look a little further into red rice yeast, part of that compound, there was some question from the FDA because it looked like it contained similar compounds to one of the statin kinds of medicines, right. Lovastatin in particular. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at that, the reason they say you have to be careful about that is because, as we know, an undesirable, rare side effect the statins can have is an effect on the liver. There is one called removed from the market for that specific reason. So the other challenge, I think, in looking at red rice yeast, why are you looking at that in preference to, say, a prescription medicine? Help me with that a little bit.
I don't like to take prescription medicines.
Okay.
And if this works as well or better.
Well, the challenge, I don't know that it's better. Certainly, if you want to take a look at that specific product, you can take a look at www.nccam. N is in Nancy, C is in cat, yes. A is in apple, M is in Mary, mm-hmm. N is in Nancy, I is in Indian, H is in health, mm-hmm. .gov, and that's the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine.
Oh.
And they'll have an objective opinion if they've looked at it, and that's a good place to go. Another place is www.clinicaltrials, all one word, mushed together, .gov, and they'll tell you about that. But thinking about cholesterol, one of the things that you have to be sure about, what I advocate for prescription medicines, is that you know the goals. And I think if you're going to look at something as serious and yet asymptomatic as cholesterol, what I'd really like you to do is to talk to your doctor about it and say, you know, what are the goals for this cholesterol that we're trying to do? And what should we be at as a target, and when should we reach it? And then you can make a plan and say, usually what happens with a prescription-type medicine, a statin for cholesterol, or one that blocks some of the cholesterol that gets in through your diet, mm-hmm. you look at about 3 months, sometimes 2 months, and you set a target. And if you're not there, you need to adjust it. So please be circumspect, because, you know, the leading killer of women in this country is heart disease, and you want to avoid that.
Well, I was taking Lipitor, and it dropped it. A lot,
uh-huh.
the cholesterol. I mean, it worked very well, but so you think there's no point in changing if that works real well?
Well, at the risk of revealing the one that I take, that's also the one that I take. And, you know, I have a rather complicated family history with both diabetes and heart disease. They kind of go hand in hand. And if you're getting a great response and you're not having side effects or problems, then, boy, you got to stay on target with cholesterol. It's once you become a cholesterol patient, that's a commitment you make for a lifetime. You're sort of a heart patient for life, mm-hmm. and that's how you get the best results, is by taking it exactly as prescribed, following up with those lab tests, and keeping it off your arteries. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good strategy, Steve, what you have.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
All right, thanks very much for the call.
It's a brilliant question, though, David, you know,
yeah. mm-hmm.
because if you were to add red rice yeast onto the Lipitor that she's taking or that I'm taking, you'd in essence be getting two statins, and that can be too much of a medicine, and you can actually have increased risk for adverse effects. So you got to be careful about it's herbal, it's natural, because a lot of them have active ingredients that are just like prescription drugs.
Yeah. Well, again, that's, I think, a good reason to consult a book like yours, whether someone goes out and buys it or whether they go to the library or however they want to do it.
Any of the above.
Because there is that real possibility that if people are taking some kind of supplement, something they bought over the counter, that it might indeed interact with the prescription medicine. And I think sometimes people are a little shy about discussing these things with their doctors.
Oh, I understand that.
And, you know,
please do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, there was one that came up interestingly. The FDA actually said, you know, you got to pull this off the market. Our listeners can find that at www.fda.gov/MedWatch. And there was a product, natural product, Actra-RX or Ulishen, and it was found to have 55 milligrams of Viagra in it. And it was promoted as something for male sexual enhancement, and, well, no surprise, it had more than a prescription dose of Viagra in it. So the FDA said, no, let's not do that. So you have to be very careful and ask, well, what's in this stuff? What does it really do before you start something on your own?
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller on our toll-free line. This is our line number 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes, good morning. Is it safe to mix Viagra with Dilantin?
That's an interesting question. I've never gotten that one before.
I've been taking Dilantin for about 12 years.
And have you added that on and got a prescription for it?
Pardon me?
Have you added that medicine on and gotten a prescription for it?
Yes.
And did it come up on the drug interaction screen?
You mean Viagra or?
Yes. When you got the prescription filled, usually what would happen is they would take a look and they would actually do a drug interaction screen.
Okay.
And so when you got it, when you picked it up from the pharmacy, did they say anything about that?
No.
And then did you get both prescriptions at the same place?
No, I've never taken Viagra yet.
Oh, okay.
I'm just curious.
Okay.
No.
Well, the interesting thing with that is that may come up as there are always, degrees of possible medicine interactions.
Okay.
And so when you look at it, what you're telling me is that you've been taking Dilantin, the generic name is Phenytoin, that's actually a seizure medicine for our listeners.
Yeah.
And what that can do, the way that Dilantin's removed, it follows a weird sort of removal process called Michaelis-Menten, but doesn't matter. It uses some enzymes in the liver to be removed from your body. Now, the interesting thing is that because it sort of ramps up those liver enzymes, that way that your body removes the medicine that you're taking, it may actually decrease the effects of sildenafil or Viagra. So it's one of those things where there may be less of a benefit, but as far as I'm aware, it's not that sort of thing where you can't combine it.
Okay.
But it's an interesting question.
Okay. I'm sure I'm not the only one with that question.
Sure.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I don't want to, we've talked about this before, and I don't want to sound like a nag, but for the very reason that you just cite and the thing that we've talked about, the possibility for drug interactions,
sure.
the general recommendation is if people can, they get all their prescriptions filled at the same place, because then they'll have a record of what the person is taking, and there should be some way that they should do that to screen just to make sure that there are no interactions.
But you know, we all like to shop. And when you look at, you know, the cost of medicines, and I know how they can be a barrier. I put a table in this year's Essential Guide about, you know, how to get help with the cost of medicines. But the key thing, again, is you so astutely brought up, if you go to more than one pharmacy, if you see more than one doctor, my God, they're not clairvoyant. They may be very smart, but they don't know everything you're taking. And so even if it's non-prescription, even if it's herbal and you don't think there's a possibility of a problem, tell them about it. Just, you know, make a list and bring it to everybody you see.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Thomas Rybacki. He is a clinical assistant professor at the University of Maryland. He is also the editor of a book that's been coming out now annually with annual updates for a number of years. And the new version is The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2005. It's published by HarperCollins. And also, if you're interested in him or in the subject, he does have a website, which is www.medicineinfo.com. And here this morning, it's your opportunity to call in. And if you have questions about medicines that you might be taking, you are certainly welcome to do that here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And on we go to another caller here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you, I don't know if this is too far afield from what you had mentioned, but just catching on your comment that heart disease was the largest cause of death in women in the United States?
Yes.
One quick question, does that expand to other countries, other quote-unquote developed countries as well?
That's a great question. There's some controversy about that, about how generalizable that is. In countries that may not be as developed, there's still is that prevalence. It may be a little different in the sense of men versus women. Actually, in the most recent data, you can find that at www.americanheart.org in their statistics. More women than men died from heart disease in the most recent year. But certainly if you look to Canada, in fact, they've got actually incredible maps of where heart disease impacts and who it impacts, it still tends to be that leading cause of death. And again, something that if you look at risk factors, if you look at diabetes and prediabetes and blood pressure and exercise and my God, smoking, please don't smoke, you can control a lot of it if you start early. I mean, I have that family history, and if you get a handle on it, you know, you can always do a little bit better in preventing it.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
All right, very good. Thanks for the call. Let's go to line number two for another person right here. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
There's a million questions.
There always are.
That's a trouble. Well, being a clinical chemist is where I'm coming from, and I have it really nice. But anyway, long time ago, when I decided I was going to be a doctor and save the world from whatever was going to be saved from.
A lot to be saved from.
I started to reading the national formularies, and that's when I first started understanding about, you know, the actual herbal use and stuff. Then, then I would tell people, I said, well, yeah, they're okay, but they're not in the concentration you can get in a shot or a pill.
Interesting
point. You might have to eat a pound of the damn thing to get what one shot would do. But anyway, what frightened me is when you said that the FDA had this particular thing removed because it had more than the pharmaceutical dosage of Viagra in a thing. And how do people get, I mean, there's no control at all. They can just put out a bottle and say, this is herb indium something, and that's it?
Well, the remarkable thing to me, and I've wondered that myself, there was a product that I don't know if it was reformulated or not, but it was called Diabetic Angel, and it actually had a pharmacologic concentration of one of the medicines that lowers blood sugar in it. So, of course, it was controlling blood sugar, and when the FDA found that, they said, well, you guys got to take this off the market because the goal is not to get the blood sugar to zero. It's to get it into a controlled range, you know, usually about 70 to 120. Mm-hmm. And the challenge with all of this is that when you look at these particular products and supplements in general, they're regulated under the 1994 Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. And my understanding is that Dr. Crawford at the FDA is seeking to develop a science-based plan for dietary supplement enforcement. And the remarkable thing is, if you look at Canada, these things are actually approved like their medicines are, their prescription drugs are. And I think it's time, you know, to take a look at that and say, well, okay, if we just had a caller who wanted to think about trying a red yeast extract instead of a prescription drug, I think we ought to know then, who can this help, how much can it help, and what's the best population, just like a prescription medicine.
Yeah, and it's
a great point.
We're like we were at the turn of the century when the medicine and cure craze was going on.
Oh, my gosh.
Probably, you had a placebo control, then you killed a lot of people.
It's remarkable. When you think about identity, purity, and stability, and what used to not happen in proving safety and efficacy, I mean, my gosh, the stuff that was out there, I mean, you had cocaine and some soft drinks and things that...
Coke.
Oh, boy.
And the second quickie, which is maybe just being political, I guess, but how is it the FDA can order all that foreign flu vaccine when those countries are known not to have the medical niceties that we do, quote unquote?
That's a great question. I actually saw that today. Of course, for all of our listeners, we know that there was a problem with only two companies making flu vaccine. And what's recently happened is that another 5 million doses were identified. And I think Health and Human Services has been scrambling because, of course, when you look at it, there were about 61 million doses from last year used. And they set a target of 100 million. And there have been, in my understanding, about 38 million given. Thank God it's been a mild flu season so far. But what happened was, and this sort of gets into that whole importation-reimportation issue, they identified product from Canada and Germany. And in general, when you look at that reimportation issue, the question is, does the FDA have the staff and the wherewithal to actually look at Jim Rybacki getting his medicines from Canada, making sure they're safe, particularly if they're shipped from the internet. And the answer is no, they don't have the staff. So this, I think, was a challenging attempt, but you know, a valid attempt. And my understanding is the FDA actually checked the doses out, however they deemed that appropriate. And so the benefit is, you know, my God, each year the flu kills about 36,000 people, which is, you know, largely preventable death. So they're trying to cope with losing half of their supply. So it says, can they look at specific vaccines on sort of a case-by-case basis, and certainly a whole lot of them, a lot is a manufacturing lot, and the answer there is yes. So big challenge, and I understand the cost-related issues as well.
We certainly would happen to have other people here give us a call if you have questions for our guest, Dr. James Rybacki. You give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something really quick I just wanted to get in here.
Sure.
People will probably recall that a couple of months ago, a very popular prescription medication, Vioxx, mm-hmm. one of the COX-2 inhibitors that had been taken by a lot of people who had joint complaints, arthritis, and so forth, was withdrawn from the market because the belief was that it increased people's risk of heart attack and stroke if it was used over a long period of time. And I guess the one thing that I'm not sure that I have seen anything about was that there are other similar medicines. There's Celebrex, there's Bextra, and other drugs. And has it been determined whether those also pose the same risk? Because I don't believe that I have heard anything about, for example, someone coming along and saying, well, don't take Celebrex because there was this problem with Vioxx. Is the whole class of drugs suspect?
We need another 2 hours. this is an amazing question. Interestingly and very timely, in today's Annals of Internal Medicine, there's actually the first sort of post-controversy, I'll put it that way, study from the University of Pennsylvania. And what they looked at was 1,700 or so patients in the Philadelphia area. And the amazing thing in this, David, is that what they found in looking at those patients is that patients using either Vioxx or Celebrex, and obviously they're looking at medicines and records after the fact, were not at a significantly greater risk of having a heart attack than those who did not use either drug. So it's what does that mean? And Celebrex users actually appeared to have a lower risk of heart attack than people who didn't take either drug. So what that says, I think, is that much like the estrogen-progesterone combinations and the Women's Health Initiative controversy that happened, this may be a very rare possible side effect, maybe specific to Vioxx. It appears that Celebrex from celecoxib from the data that I've seen, and the Kaiser Permanente, even though it wasn't placebo-controlled information, doesn't appear to have the same risk that Vioxx did. And I think it's something that we need to find out, what is it that's unique about the chemical structure of Vioxx that may cause it to be more likely to cause a rare possible problem versus a placebo? And then when you look at the other medicine, Bextra actually came under fire. There was a brief blurb, and I'm not sure if that was substantiated or not, about questioning the cardiovascular safety there. My additional understanding is that the manufacturer of Celebrex has actually undertaken a 2-year study looking at heart disease patients, and that was part of the controversy from Dr. Topol, a cardiologist from Cleveland Clinic, saying, well, how well have we looked at these things, and how do we know what we know? Because, of course, no one wants to have a catastrophic side effect, neither does companies, I'm sure, from a medicine used to treat arthritis.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, you know, and I did say that I hadn't heard anybody raising concerns about the other COX-2 mm-hmm. inhibitors. And in fact, that's not quite right because, again, people might recall last month there was a story. There was a physician, a scientist who worked for the FDA, a man named Dr. David Graham, who was testifying before the Senate, who came up with a list of five drugs that he was, medicines that he was concerned about, and Bextra was on his list.
I can do that in my sleep. It was Accutane, Bextra, Crestor, Meridian, Cerevent.
Right.
You're exactly right. And it's something that part of the controversy that arose after that in questioning both what the FDA was doing, but, you know, what had happened, came in part from Dr. Graham, Dr. Avorn from Harvard, questioned a culture of denial at the FDA, and the FDA and the Center for CDER, the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, said, well, you know, we look at things, and here's how we look at them. And then I think some of the testimony before Congress became controversial. And there's been some discussion about, well, let's have, first of all, the Institute of Medicine take a look at how the FDA does what it does. And I think in fairness to any organization, it's really hard to take a look at yourself and what you do and how you do it, especially how you do it over time. And so my understanding is we're going to take a look at that. One of the challenges I think they'll find is that basically what we have is a voluntary system for reporting adverse effects. And the next question is probably, how well do we look at medicines after they're approved? That's called pharmacovigilance. And the question, I think, is do we need to strengthen that? And I think the IOM will come out with a yes.
Well, we're at our midpoint here. We have other callers. In fact,
okay.
The lines are full. We'll get right to them in a
Oops.
Second. But no, that's fine. We do, however, as this is the first Tuesday of the month, there's something we need to do right now, and that's it. This is a test of the emergency alert system.
Message was instituted by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. This station is participating in a required monthly test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
And this is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And also joining us as our guest is Dr. James Rybacki. He is clinical assistant professor at the University of Maryland. He is a spokesman for the American Heart Association's Get With The Guidelines program, has done some work working with people who have experienced heart disease, and he is the editor of the new edition of the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs for 2005. It's been coming out now every year with an annual update. It is published by HarperCollins, and the book contains profiles of a great many prescription medicines, information on there, what they are, something about how they're supposed to work, what they're for, the dosage, and also more important, or perhaps more important, information about possible side effects and drug interactions, the kind of things that happen when you're taking more than one medicine. And also, as we mentioned, something that I think is very helpful is that it does have information about potential interactions between herbal and over-the-counter supplements and prescription medicines that people are taking, because there are certainly cases where you do not, there are certain things you do not want to take them together. It's a good resource, so you might take a look at it. And here, questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a number of other callers, and we'll get right back to them and next talk with somebody on our line three right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Hi.
I have a question related to cholesterol.
Okay.
I'm a person that's naturally got a very high cholesterol rating. I'm pretty on a low-fat diet. I've been through most of the statin drugs with my doctor, and I can't tolerate most of them. I get a high liver enzyme reading after about 3 months, and so I've been on several of them. The last year or two, I went on a new one that came out called Zetia.
Zetamide, uh-huh.
Also on a high amount of niacin, about 22,000 milligrams of niacin a day, and it seems to be tolerable. It doesn't probably lower the cholesterol like the statins done, but I guess my question is this combination of something that I guess won't be harmful to me down the road? Is it better to take it than not to take it, I guess?
That's a great question. The question in any medicine, of course, is a benefit to risk decision. Niacin, in looking at what that does, there's actually a combination form that combines lovastatin, one of the statins, with niacin. That's called Advocor, and there's very interesting data for that. What you're actually doing is something that with the niacin itself, your doctor probably checks some liver enzymes, and that's something you need to do with higher doses of niacin. So for our listeners, it is not something you want to add on your own. This is something where it's pharmacotherapy, even though it's a vitamin, and it's something that, again, liver enzymes should be checked, rare possible side effects. Do you flush from that at all? Does your face get kind of red when you take it, the niacin?
No, I tell you, when I first started, I first gradually increased, but now it bothers me very little. Once in a while, I feel a little flushiness, but really, I tolerate it very well.
Excellent, and that's a very common side effect. The Zeti itself is ezetimibe. This is interesting in the sense that if we look at cholesterol and where it comes from, what people miss is if you have the worst fatty diet, that probably accounts for about 20% of what we call abnormal cholesterol, and 80% of it we make in our liver. So what you've got is the Zetia that's blocking some of that absorption from your diet, and of course that's a good thing, the niacin, which is helping some of that production of cholesterol. And the thing that is interesting that I've become aware of is something called polycosinol, P-O-L-I-C-O-S-I-N-A-L. And that's actually a product that was developed in Cuba, which is interesting in the sense of the sugar cane that they have. But that's actually a supplement additive that you may want to ask your doctor about. There's some data on it that looks like it will help lower cholesterol, and it's sort of a waxy substance. There's a specific dosing regimen you need to follow. But that may be an interesting question to address a little bit more of the cholesterol that your body's making.
Would you add that to what I'm taking, or would you drop one of those if use the polycosinol?
No, you talk to your doctor about both of those and what the goals and targets are, because those should be specific to your family history. And, you know, when you look at it, the guidelines always change. A gentleman named Dr. Grunde came out with an adjustment for the National Cholesterol Education Program targets. And if you fall into a very high-risk category, one of the optional goals is 70 milligrams as a target for that bad or LDL cholesterol. So you need to individualize that. And I wouldn't drop a medicine ever without talking to your doctor, okay?
Okay, well, thank you much.
Oh, you bet. You stay on target with that.
Very good. Okay, well, thanks for the call. We'll continue. We'll keep taking calls. Our next is our line number 4 right here. Hello. Is there a caller there on line 4, toll-free line?
Line 4.
Yes, go ahead.
Good morning, David Inch, regular guest, Dr. James Reibach.
I'm having just a little
Illinois
trouble hearing.
The doctor said he was having trouble hearing the caller. Maybe just try to speak up a little bit more. That would help us.
Yes, sir.
Very good.
Dr. Reibach, the essential monosaccharides, which are discussed in Harper's Biochemistry, you were asked on a previous program about the essential monosaccharides. Have you had an opportunity to consider the monosaccharides as nutrients? And if so, what are you finding with reference to essential monosaccharide supplementation?
I took a look, and I could not find much. Do you have a good source for me to look further?
Glycoscience.com is a website that has questions about them, but it's kind of professional-oriented, so that's how come I had the question.
Okay, well, I can certainly read professional. I've got several degrees in professional, and I will take a look at that. This is something you're an advocate of?
Not until I know more about it, although I have looked into it and begun some essential monosaccharide supplementation.
Now, what's the goal of the treatment? What are you trying to do with it, and when do you expect to achieve it?
It is a panacea for well-being as presented by the community. What I hope to do is overcome health deficiencies,
okay,
and those are many.
I'm sorry to hear that. My challenge is always when I hear Panacea, I need to know, you know, who it was studied in, what it did, how rigorous it was, and I always say, you know, show me the science. The challenge in that, in taking a brief look, if you take another look at www.clinicaltrials.gov or NCCAM, that's where, in my experience, you tend to find the science that's placebo-controlled, and
I did look at those and didn't find...
And same thing, I looked again, and I didn't find anything, and that's always been sort of my evidence base for, you know, where's the science behind some health claims, and part of what I think we'll see from Dr. Crawford at FDA is more of a science-based plan for dietary supplements where it becomes, okay, if you think this particular product does that, what's the concentration? What have you done with that? And going back to NMRs and gas liquid chromatography and a past life and some heavy lab science that I have, let's figure out what it is that's the active ingredient. And I think once you do that and then you do some real studies, then maybe we can make some conclusions about it. Right now, I don't know enough to say anything other than that. I hope that's helpful, though.
All right. Well, thank you. We'll go on here. Next caller up's line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
I'm interested in knowing your comments about something I've heard elsewhere about drugs in general. It seems in recent years or maybe even the last decade that the number of absolutely new compounds that are being FDA approved is relatively small compared to the number of combination drugs that are being approved. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
That's a very interesting comment. When you look at new molecular entities, NMEs, which is kind of the nerdy term we're talking about, in general, if you look at new drug applications, there's around 100 a year. Some years, 121 comes to mind, 98, and I believe 111 most recently. You can find that at FDA.gov. The true novel medicines that come up are interesting in the sense of, I tend to put those in the true breakthrough sections of the Essential Guide, and you're right, there's a much smaller number of those versus sort of minimize the side effect, structure-activity relationship kinds of compounds, and I think perhaps in some sense I very much agree with that. Combination therapy, given how challenged we all can be in taking medicines, makes some sense to me because you can get that benefit of two medicines in one pill. It's hard for me to remember the two medicines that I take a day, and I think that combination can help with adherence or compliance.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And to next line number two. Hello.
Hi, I have a question related to the statins. Let me start by saying that I have idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy.
Okay.
So with congestive heart failure, which my cardiologist says is not, in his category, heart disease, when people are generally speaking about heart disease. And I also have a defibrillator resynchronization pacemaker implant.
You now, have a complicated history, but go ahead.
Yeah, and I was diagnosed 12 years ago, and when they said there was an 80% mortality within 5 years.
Oh, my God, congratulations. Wow.
Yeah, the drugs have gotten a lot better. And they put me on an ACE inhibitor, and then they decided the megadose, at which point I lost all taste. And I had looked it up in your book, and it was listed as a side effect.
Yep.
And yet I had three cardiologists and my general practitioners. I mean, there's a lot of people taking ACE inhibitors.
Sure.
And they had never seen anybody actually have this side effect. And it took them about 7 years before my doctor said, hey, I found someone else who had the same side effect.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Okay. Now, here's the question.
Okay, one quick segue. Yeah. The thing that would be very helpful, and one thing that we tend to miss, is if your doctor would fill out a case report form that can actually go online to MedWatch, MedWatch, at the FDA. But when you get that kind of documentation, we tend to under-document adverse effects in general, and I think that's just helpful. But please, go to your question.
Okay, I'll definitely tell him that. My question is this. I had about cholesterol. My numbers were okay, high HDL, LDL. cholesterol. Then suddenly, after about a year, I've been on Lesco for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
My numbers went bad, so my cholesterol went up to 218, and I forget the other numbers, but they weren't good. So my doctor, my general practitioner, said, oh, it's great. The HMO just approved our giving out Crestor. So I went on Crestor, and I said, well, wait a minute. I'm a little bit concerned about these reports. I said, I want to have a kidney function test done when I've been on this drug.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on it, and in 6 weeks, my cholesterol dropped from 218 to 123.
Wow.
And all my other numbers went really well. And I have two questions. The first one is this. I sort of figured, well, Crestor is good, and they must be keeping an eye on this now because of the Vioxx scandal, which I consider a scandal. And although I don't want to end up being one of the statistics that make them decide to pull it from the market.
No, I understand.
The question related to the Crestor is, how often should I be testing my kidney function? Because maybe after 2 months, you don't know. Maybe it doesn't. You had someone on the phone before who didn't have trouble for 3 or 4 months after his statins. And they had done a whole test on all the statins, except Crestor wasn't included because it wasn't out at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, when I told my cardiologist how great this was with my cholesterol, he said, well, first of all, you don't have common heart disease. Your biggest problem is your triglyceride level, which wasn't affected by the Crestor. And my general practitioner said, well, I don't understand why that's important and not the cholesterol. So as a person who works in the heart field and in terms of taking drugs that questions have been raised about, that's your risk-benefit question.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how to deal with it. My doctors don't seem to be much help in how I should make that decision. So if you could talk about that a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
We need 2 hours, I think. The first question, relative to Crestor, that's one of the medicines that Dr. Graham put on that list of five and questioned possibility of kidney difficulties. To my knowledge, there have not been guidelines elaborated as to how often, if you're taking that particular medicine, that should be checked. The immediate response from the manufacturer was that they hadn't been asked for any specific information relative to kidney function and checking it. The safest answer, I think, is to discuss that with your doctor, and in that sense of concerns, you're getting a good response from it. Part of the difficulty in cholesterol in general is that when you look at low-density lipoprotein, what we typically view as the target, there's actually 7 different kinds. And when you look at high-density lipoproteins, there's at least 5 different kinds. And it has to do with, if you make small, dense, bad cholesterol, the LDL, you tend to glom on to blood vessels more. And if you make the wrong kind of high-density lipoprotein, and I know this is a little complicated, but it tends not to act like a taxi and carry cholesterol back to your liver where you can make things with it. So part of that risk or that challenge, just in looking at numbers like that, may be how well it functions versus just the numbers. That's sort of a new thing in heart disease and how that works. There's two companies, Liposcience and Berkeley Heart, that look at panels of those things and try to determine risk from that. At the risk of going a little further, part of the question, looking at triglycerides, and you said your cardiologist was most concerned about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. well, when you look at those, if that's the concern, medicines called fibrates in general look at triglycerides or some dietary approaches as well. And the challenge there becomes the combination with a statin, which can make adverse effects more likely. That was also a paper that came out from Dr. Graham and his group looking at that specific combination with one of the medicines that was taken off the market. So it's a fair question. I would bring that back to the cardiologist and say, you know what, where do we want to get all of the numbers, including the triglycerides, and there are also C-reactive proteins, ApoE, homocysteine, other non-traditional risk factors that you may want to bring up as well. What a complicated question.
Yeah, I do want to say, I just remembered, the reason he told me the triglycerides were important, and the only way that he knew of to control it was to cut down on carbohydrates.
Well, it's interesting when you look at the biochemistry of that. If you got a real starchy diet, that's part of the question. And the other thing that I have always found wonderful is a dietary consult. The dietitians can do very interesting things with that. The other part question in that is the benefit of fish oil, how that might work. There's been some very interesting data with omega-3 fatty acids and how those can help in that whole picture as well. But my word, stay on top of that. What a fantastic question.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have 7-8 minutes left. We have some other callers. We'll try to get as many as we can. This is just what I expected would happen when we have you on the show. People really and obviously what it says is that people have a lot of questions about their medicines. And,
oh, but that's a great thing.
And they're not sure where to go.
But it's always okay to ask questions and to stay on top of that. And where there's emerging science and there are concerns, particularly within a class, you know, back to our last caller, if there's that concern about Crest or rosuvastatin, there's several other choices within that family of statins that also have very great effectiveness data and don't appear to have that. I'm not even sure it's characterizable as real. It's perhaps potential, and I'm not sure of what data Dr. Graham had that I'm not aware of for that.
Our guest, Dr. James Rybacki, he's clinical assistant professor at University of Maryland. He's the editor of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2005, published by HarperCollins. And questions, we continue to have people who call in here with questions. We'll try to get him in the time that remains. And next up, we'll have someone on our line number 3. Hello.
Hi. You touched on this just a little bit before, but can you talk about the advisability of combining Lipitor with Gemfibrozil and what kind of monitoring should be done on a regular basis?
When you look at that and what you're talking about is that whole combination, and atorvastatin or Lipitor happens to be the one that I take. And the question in looking at those particular possible interactions, when you look at a possible increased risk of a rare side effect, which is myositis or muscle changes or damage or myopathy, what is interesting in that sense is that the combination for patients who need the combination is gets back to that benefit and risk decision. And there's something called creatine kinase. You hear it abbreviated as CK. And that's something that can show early changes in muscles. The other question as well is liver function tests and how that works. And the overriding goal is making sure that you're controlling the risk factors that you have. And that Lopit or Gemfibrozil combination with a statin may have an increased risk. So it's something to be monitored without question.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
All right, very good. And so we will continue. And the next person in line is on our line 4, I believe. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'm postmenopausal. My doctor put me on Actonol because I had osteopenia.
Wait. I missed the name. Put you on?
Actonol, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Resedzonate, yep.
Yeah.
That's a bisphosphonate medicine for an osteopenia for our listeners is sort of a low bone mass.
Right.
Okay.
And I was wondering, it has not, I've been on it almost 2 years, has not improved it. In fact, it declined a little bit. They said I had it in the hip. Could it be isolated there, or if you have it, you have it?
Well, the interesting challenge with that, I'm actually on a task force in Maryland establishing osteoporosis guidelines for the state. We have some information at www.strongerbones.org.
Oh, okay.
And when you look at this and you look at osteoporosis, osteopenia is that sort of drawing on your bone bank where you've gotten down to a certain level. Did you have a DEXA scan? Do you remember that? Did you lay on a table? Okay.
Yes, I did.
And the interesting part with that, when you look at spine and hip data, the reason that usual insurers only pay for a repeat test every 2 years is that that's within sort of the accuracy of the machines.
Mm.
Now, the other combination and the other question I would ask you is, with the Actonol, are you taking calcium and vitamin D?
Yes, I am. I'm taking a supplement, I think 500 milligrams.
Okay. One of the things And when you look at it, kind of what you can absorb, usually about 400 is what you can absorb, and the okay. target, and you may be losing some of that. You know, it's perfectly acceptable.
Okay.
The question of vitamin D, and is that 400 IU in it, or how much?
I'm taking the little chocolates.
You're taking Viactive, yep.
Yes, right.
Yep, okay. So the question in all of that is, you may want to ask your doctor about getting a vitamin D level. The interesting challenge in somewhat esoteric science is that there are some vitamin D receptor alleles, and boy, does that get complicated. What it means, though, is that even though you're getting vitamin D, you may not absorb it and work with it well. So one of the tests you may want to talk to your doctor about is a vitamin D level, and of course, if we don't go out in the sun and you're not outside, you have to make active vitamin D, you may not be doing that. That can relate to that whole picture and effectiveness of the bisphosphonate, the actinol that you're taking. Now, are you going to get another test and follow up on that?
Well, I just had a test.
Okay.
I just had my test this year, and it didn't show any improvement, but he just said that who knows how it would have been if I had not been taking it.
Yes,
so.
And of course, the other side of that story is, well, but you didn't lose any more, and that's a good thing. Stability is a good thing. That's fine. The other question, though, again, is that vitamin D and getting that specific test and then adjusting vitamin D intake if that's low, not on your own. And then, of course, the interesting part of osteoporosis is there's now some additional medicines that can bring to bear. What that medicine Actinel works on is something called an osteoclast, which sort of breaks down bone. There's a newer medicine called Forteo or teriparatide. I'm sorry to say that on the radio, but Forteo is the brand name that you may want to ask about. That works on the cells called osteoblasts that actually can build up bone. So the question is, okay, are we comfortable with where we are? And is the vitamin D there? Is the calcium there? And is the target about 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day?
Well, no, I'm only taking one of those little chocolates.
Oh.
I'm not taking any more calcium than that.
Okay. Our diets, my diet, my daughter's diets, tend not to be real rich in calcium. And if you look at the number of servings of dairy that you get a day,
okay.
and you sort of assign a value of about 200 to that, and I think some of that dietary information is on that strongerbones.org. If
okay.
you're not getting that 1,200 to 1,500 or so of calcium, then that may be part of the issue as well, because you got to give your body.
I thought you could take too much calcium.
Oh, you can, and there's no question about that. But the usual target, if you look at www.nof.org, that's the National Osteoporosis Foundation, and also that strongerbones.org, you'll get sort of, given your age, the calcium that you want to get in your diet, and that may be part of the picture in that the Actinel may be stopping those osteoclasts from breaking down the bone, but you may not be giving your body enough to build it back up.
I'm going to jump in here because we got to go. We've used our time. No, you should not apologize. That's what we do these programs for. Our guest, James Rybacki, the book, The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, 2005, HARP.